It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our handful of conversations to end this news week, as we like to do here on our News Buzz edition on Friday, we'll hear about some fascinating research that's been going on at the University of Iowa to document how tumors form and how we can stop them, cancer tumors, from forming. We'll also talk with Dr. Terry Walls. She's been on this program before. She has a new book out. It's a companion book. It's called The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life, a big name in functional medicine. Dr. Terry Walls will be with us a little bit later in the program. First of all, let's start our show, as we have been doing for many weeks, because there's a lot of activity at the State House in Des Moines. Iowa lawmakers getting close to the end of the session. We're going to talk again with Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Lots of things popping. Let's talk about the gun bill. What are the measures? This gun bill has been signed now by the governor. How will we be different here in Iowa with gun laws?
Well, it's the most expansive gun bill in the state's history, as the supporters were happy to say. Got some national press as a result of how extensive this gun bill is. It was quite a festive atmosphere in the governor's formal office for the bill signing. A lot of people worked on this bill for a long time. We've talked about the main provisions, the stand your ground language, enhancing self-defense for gun owners who fire deadly weapons, the allowing guns in the state house. If you're a permit holder, a concealed permit, you can carry your weapon into the state house. That's going to involve some new security measures there. You know, those, I don't know if you've been at the state house lately, but the folks that we all do go through, well, I go through a metal detector every time I enter the building, but state employees walk right in. But at any rate, they will have a new responsibility to check the gun permit of anyone bringing in a weapon. More confidentiality for permit holders, the child provision where children can hold handguns with the supervision of a parent, and a number of other. Oh, the other really controversial thing was Iowa law already prevents local governments from having firearms restrictions that are tougher than state law. However, some local governments have seen fit to ban firearms in their government buildings, courthouses, and such. This bill will simply let somebody who's unhappy about that, someone who doesn't like that restriction, to sue in court in order to, as the supporters would say, uphold their Second Amendment rights. So that's the gist of it. The gun advocates are already looking forward to next year for further expansions of gun rights.
Let's talk about bike safety. That's been debated throughout this session, of course, spurred by the spate of bicyclist deaths here in the state. What's happening there?
Well, that bill has been, it's still technically alive, but the bill's supporter made clear that it's not going to go any further this year. It had a couple of things in it. The thing they've been trying to get for a while is, when you pass a bicyclist, this bill would have required you to get all the way into the other lane, just like you were passing a car. Required lights on backs of bikes from sunset to sunrise, and another one to allow when you're in a vehicle and you're following a bicyclist and you're in a no passing zone. This seemed counterintuitive to me, but the bill would have also said that you can pass a bicyclist in a no-passing zone, the idea being that it really does kind of create a danger on the road for that long stretch. Sometimes it's a mile and a half.
Right.
For that long
stretch. It's real
step
curvy
be,
and so forth, yeah.
Right. For that long stretch to be, you know, riding right up behind a bicyclist. So that seemed like kind of a mixed message there, but that was part of the bill. The bill's backers said simply that there's just a real divide between bicyclists and people who think that Iowa roadways were meant for cars, and they just weren't able to get the two sides together.
Okay, so it looks like nothing will happen with specifically bike safety this session, is what I hear you saying, Joyce.
You know, there are a couple of things having to do with distracted driving, which of course affects distracted driving and drunk driving, which also of course affects cyclists as well.
Right, right. Talk about that, this distracted driving, the one that's come up in the recent years, texting while driving. Our cell phones, we love them so much, right? They keep us from our eyes off the road in many cases. So what's been happening there?
Well, the legislature has completed its work on that. They gave final passage this week to a bill to make texting while driving a primary offense. We've talked about that before. Currently, texting while driving is illegal, but you can only be charged with that if you get pulled over for something else. This bill will make it a primary offense, meaning that an officer can, if it looks like you're texting, can pull you over for that. Now, there's some obvious problems with that. You know, it's kind of hard to prove. You know, it's so easy for a driver to say, well, I wasn't texting. And the backers of this bill really acknowledge that weakness in the bill. But the bill's sponsor made, which I thought was kind of an interesting point, he said, okay, you're going to officer's going to pull you over because it looks like you're texting. You're going to say, well, I wasn't texting. But it, in effect, presents an educable moment or a teaching moment to say, well, it sure looked like you were texting, and this is why you shouldn't be. This
right.
is why
and it
it's
wasn't
dangerous.
Joyce, wasn't it that the law enforcement was in favor of just, hey, if you have your cell phone in your hand and you're behind the wheel, that's an offense. That would have been the most extreme case, which isn't going to happen.
It's not going to happen, but there was another bill to that effect to actually not let you hold your cell phone in your hand while you're driving. And Governor Branstad came out in favor of that, although he did not submit a bill to that effect. He kind of left it to the legislature, and with maybe kind of predictable results, that would have been a far bigger step. But there are some states that are doing that, actually requiring no handheld cell phones in the car.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a couple of other things before we have to say goodbye for this week, Joyce. Flood center funding debated and then restored. This is interesting. Flooding becoming more frequent, more serious in Iowa. The thinking behind cutting it?
Well, this is a very one of my colleagues called this an austere budget year, and I agree with that. There's a just very, very tight budgets all the way across the board. Most state agencies getting less to spend this year than they were given last year to spend. And so the Flood Center, that's part of the education budget, big cuts to education, all of the region's institutions getting another round of cuts, and cutting the Flood Center was part of that. There was a big hue and cry, and that's one of the few things that they have. There have been a big hue and cry about several things, and that's one where they have walked that one back. However, they're going to restore the funding to the Flood Center. They're going to take a big chunk of that out of the University of Iowa's budget, so there's plenty not to like there.
Medical marijuana. How does that happen in a unified government under the Republicans in Iowa?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, the last several years, the Democrats in the Senate have passed wide open medical marijuana bills where marijuana would be grown and processed and sold here in Iowa. A wide range of covering a wide range of illnesses, not just epilepsy, like the very, very limited law that we have now. And, you know, the Democrats in the Senate have been arguing for this for a long time. Republicans are now in the majority, and it turns out there was plenty of Republican sentiment for this as well. I attribute this to the really effective advocacy and lobbying that that people have done at the Capitol year after year after year. I think Republicans heard that just like any normal person would hear that, and they now have a bill to do that. It looks like it's going to pass the full Senate. It passed two committees already this week.
And so specifically this step, we've already taken a small step in medical marijuana, but in the few seconds we have left, what is this step then specifically?
Grow, process, and distribute marijuana in the state, but I can't let you go any further before I say it's not going to pass the House. That's the
okay.
That's the real thing here. It caused a lot of, you know, there was a lot of interest in this. The advocates, I haven't talked to any advocates since this came up this week, but I'm sure that they're encouraged by this getting through one chamber. It's a years-long process, mm-hmm. apparently. But that's where it stands immediately. One of the law and order people in the House who actually supports medical marijuana but is realistic said, can I say this on the radio? It will be a cold day and you know where.
Oh, got it, Joyce.
Before this passes the House this year.
Joyce Russell, it's all the time we have right now. Thanks for the quick update from our Capitol, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Have a pleasant weekend, Easter weekend, Joyce.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The community of Mason City is mourning the deaths of five of its young people. You perhaps heard about this. Earlier this week, five teens dying in a Jeep, I guess it was, in a fiery crash in Mason City. It's a crash that's still being investigated. Kyle Munson joins me now, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kyle.
Oh, hi there. Hey, Ben. Good to be with you.
You spent the day in Mason City earlier this week learning about those who were lost. Tell us about the young lives we lost here in Iowa.
Yeah, it was tragic. I was just so compelled. I felt like I should go up there. Five kids, five students, five young people from between the ages of 14 and 20 were driving in the wee hours of Monday, late Sunday night into early Monday morning this week, when for some reason the Jeep Liberty they were in veered off the road right kind of in the heart of the city. It's the main east-west artery that goes through town just as it branches into separate one-way lanes. There's a median there with a little triangle park and a Mason City welcome sign. Veered off the road, went through some guide wires, knocking out power to local residents, and slammed into a tree, burst into flames, and they all died at the scene. It was just a horrible accident.
Yeah. You visited a makeshift memorial there. Was that right at the scene of the crash?
Yeah, it was at the scene of the crash. And, a lot of people have probably seen this type of thing happen before on roadsides. This was particularly heart-wrenching, in part because it was in the center of town, which isn't always the case in these things. And there had been a tree. So the one tree they had hit was uprooted and removed, but there was another tree immediately next to it that happened to have, five branches on it. And so the road crews had cut that down too. And so that became the center of the memorial with, for the five kids, one of their names on each of these, branches in the trunk. Mm-hmm. And people were decorating it with flowers, pinwheels, basketball. One of the kids was a basketball player. Things were added to it. And then people kept driving up and they stood around and they shed tears, they shared memories. And it was just a continual churn.
You and your cohort there from the Des Moines Register collected a little bit of sound. I wanted to play a few seconds of some students that you collected their voices at that memorial site. Let's take a listen.
It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
It's very, very hard to wrap your mind around, honestly.
I just can't believe it's real, that it actually happened. I woke up this morning and just could not believe it at all. They just need to be remembered for who they were and how funny they were, and they'll still always be here.
Okay, Kyle. Any other words to leave us with in the wake of this tragedy and the community there and all of Iowa really mourning for these five teens?
I was just struck by, of course, their youth makes it all the harder, and the fact that they were at that point in their lives. I mean, some of them were, in or around high school, some were out of high school. Some of them had different struggles. They were trying to find their way in life, mm-hmm. but they were tied into the community in so many different ways. They were active in a church youth group. Some of them had gotten to know each other at the alternative school. One kid was a student at the high school, and they were one guy was a pool shark. People knew them and seemed to have a lot of good memories about them as having these great senses of humor and that sort of a thing. So I attended a vigil in the park that same night too. Hundreds of people turned out. There was a candle on a table, and people were signing these large cards to the families. So I was just struck by how they were woven into the fabric of the city in a lot of different ways.
Okay. Kyle Munson, thank you for giving us a little bit of what's going on, coming together of Mason City, that community, after five teens dying in a fiery crash earlier in the week. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, take care.
You too. Reminder, you know, we head into this Easter weekend, many of us traveling to be with loved ones. Drive carefully. Do not text while you drive. We know this kills. Also, don't be one of those drivers who, with one hand drives and the other hand holds a phone to your ear. We know distracted driving kills. Looked it up again just today. You can look up the statistics. Go to find over 30,000 people per year in this country die in road deaths. Another way to put that someone once told me that has stayed with me for a long time, it would be as if a fully loaded jumbo jet crashed every couple of days with no survivors throughout the entire year. Drive safely. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Exciting research in understanding cancer and new approaches to cancer prevention are happening all the time across the country. Some really important findings recently at the University of Iowa. Joining me now, University of Iowa biologist David Soule. He's a Carver Professor of Biological Science at the UI. And he and his lab at the University of Iowa have observed for the first time how cancer cells join together to form a tumor. David Soule. Saul, welcome to our program.
Hello, man.
Give us some background. Tell us, in the few minutes that we have, what you've been setting out to do in your research.
Sure. Well, this can be described as a serendipitous marriage of technologies. So for years, since 1985, I've been developing methods to reconstruct things in three dimensions. Cells, groups of cells, etc., including getting the first Iowa Development Commission grant for technology to develop a company, et cetera, et cetera. In 1996, I brought the Developmental Studies Hybridoma Bank, which is a national resource created by the National Institutes of Health, and the biggest non-commercial monoclonal antibody bank to the University of Iowa. Now, monoclonal antibodies are antibodies that are used as reagents, and they also make up close to 50% of all the cancer drugs that are half effective in fighting cancer. In 2010, my wife died of cancer, and people said, "Well, why don't you start studying cancer?" Because I have a very big research group, and I just said, "I can't make it personal." But 2 years later, in a meeting, we realized that we could actually combine the three-dimensional reconstruction technology and develop a model for recreating tumors outside the body in a gel and reconstruct them in 3D and quantitate everything. And on the other side, I had one of the biggest collections of monoclonal antibodies that could be tested as drugs to stop tumorigenesis, to stop tumors.
Okay, so you can actually see this happening now. What does that mean to see it and see how cancer forms into a tumor?
Very good question, because when we saw it, we found out things no one had ever known about it. There are actually cells that come out of these mini tumors that are produced by growth, and they actually pull the small tumors together to make the real tumor. So it was a facilitated phenomenon that no one had ever seen before. And what we could do is now we have, I've grown this collection from 100 to 5,500 monoclonal antibodies, and I have as much as I could use. So it was a situation where I could do something no one else in the world could do, unless I could go through 5,500 monoclonal antibodies and ask which one stops tumors from forming. Now, when we started doing this, we did it on breast cancer, and we were able to find that we could actually stop the tumors from actually forming, not growth. And you don't want drugs that stop growth, because they usually target molecules that stop growth in all the cells, mm-hmm. in your brain, in your body, in your muscle, in your organs. We were looking for something that was a commonality for tumors. And when we studied melanomas, which just came out last a week or two ago and got a little bit of publicity, we discovered that the same thing happened in melanomas, only at a faster rate, because they're wild. I mean, melanomas are just crazily fast. We found out that there was a commonality, that both the melanomas and the breast cells, which are completely different origin, do exactly the same thing. Now, if there's a behavioral commonality, that means that there must be a mechanistic and therefore molecular commonality, and therefore there must be a single drug, if we could find it, that could shut down not just one tumor, but all tumors, and not affect growth.
Now, wait a minute, because for years, it used to be send a mouse to college. I was in elementary school. They were looking for the single cancer.
The single bullet.
The single bullet. For years, I've interviewed cancer researchers, and it's been like, all these cancers are so different, we have to have individual cures. You're telling me the opposite.
I'm telling you that for tumors that are encapsulated, we are searching for a single bullet again, and I don't think cancer people like the idea because they've been dedicated to single pieces of single cancers. And what I'm saying is if there's a commonality, there must be a single target. If there's a single target, because I run the Developmental Studies Hybridoma Bank and have this incredible capacity to test antibodies, I will either find it or create it.
Wow, and that is a statement. How widely held is the view that you've just expressed, that there is this route?
Right now, pretty much zero, except us. But the thing is that people don't have the capacity to do it. We are so unique at the University of Iowa. We are the only ones who probably have this capability because we have an infinite amount of antibodies and variability in order to test and tremendous technology in order to create new antibodies.
Mm-hmm. We have just over a minute left.
Yes.
Give me a vision of, you're convinced of this. I can see it in your face.
I'm convinced.
How many years, and what will be the headline, and what will be achievable in a few years?
All right. I'm 75. I have a 10-year plan.
All right.
If I live that long. A 10-year plan. Within 10 years, I want a single magic bullet.
Yeah?
I think I'll be able to do it.
You will be able to do it?
I think so.
Okay. Fascinating research. That's a message of hope about cancer prevention as we head into a weekend that's all about the rebirth of life, isn't it?
That's right.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much for stopping by our studio. David Saul is a Carver Professor of Biological Science at the University of Iowa. Remember that name. Remember that prediction. We hope that you and your fellow scientists are hard at work on cancer prevention research here at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in, David.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register about moves in the Iowa legislature to stop cities from enacting sanctuary policies. Also, we get to meet, so to speak, on the radio, as much as you can meet a camel, a baby camel named Sunny that was just born at Blank Park's zoo. Also, Dr. Terry Walls, her new book, The Walls Protocol: Cooking for Life. Dr. Terry Walls will be joining us live in just a few minutes. Still plenty to come on this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. So glad you're buckled up and along on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we meet Sunny, Blank Park Zoo's new baby camel. After that, Dr. Terry Walls will join us to talk about her new book, The Walls Protocol: Cooking for Life book. She's one of the pioneers in what is called functional medicine. Stay around for that. First of all, though, back to business at the State House. Yesterday, lawmakers in the Iowa Senate approved measures that would prohibit cities and counties from enacting so-called sanctuary policies. There's also a $10 million repair project underway in the dome of the state capitol. Bill Petrosky has been writing about both of these for the Des Moines Register this week. He is state government reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ben.
We've got just a few minutes here. Tell us about the bill that passed the Senate that would bar local government from what, receiving state funds if?
That's exactly right. This would require Iowa law enforcement agencies to comply with federal immigration detainer requests for persons in their custodies. In addition, this legislation would prohibit local governments from discouraging local law enforcement or others from activities related to enforcing immigration laws. I don't know how familiar we are with this, but I mean, anybody who covered Republican campaigns like I did know that this was, a major point of interest among a lot of Republicans strongly enforcing immigration laws. This legislation, the floor manager was Senator Julian Garrett from Indianola, and he pointed out, you know, there have been many polls conducted on this kind of thing, and the public generally very strongly supports it.
And I gather by your reporting that most counties, most municipalities, that they are going along with this. There are a few that are not, and those are the ones sort of focused on in this legislation.
Yes, that's right. And I think if the point by the Democrats is their view is that there are no Iowas. Counties that are really saying we won't cooperate, there are some issues in terms of whether they can legally and constitutionally hold people.
Mm-hmm. I remember not too long ago I had the Iowa City mayor, and this is one of those communities that is, resisting, you would say, with sanctuary policies. He would not say that Iowa City was a sanctuary city.
Right.
And that's a key here, right?
That's exactly right. And you also may be aware that Des Moines Public Schools, they've publicly stated that they are supporting undocumented students, barring staff from asking about their immigration status and funneling federal inquiries through the superintendent's office and the school district's attorney.
Mm-hmm. Now, critics are charging this is going to be a burden to taxpayers, also encourage racial profiling.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, what do you see in the future here?
I think this was one of those types of issues that the Republicans it had been a big campaign issue and it was something that they wanted to see achieved. My guess is, well, this bill is now going to be sent over to the Iowa House, and my guess is that there probably won't be time to act on it this year. It is possible, you know, that in the final days of the session, something like this could move, but this is same legislation was proposed in the Iowa House, reached the calendar, but never came up for a vote. So my guess is that we've probably seen the last of it this year, but not absolutely positive, and we could see it come up again next year.
In the 1 minute that we have remaining, Bill, tell us about the repairs that are going on at the State House. The dome is getting a makeover.
That's exactly right. The dome is something iconic, you know, associated with Des Moines. You can see it from all over downtown. And they're going to be setting up scaffolding all around. In fact, they've set up scaffolding. In fact, as I was walking in the other day, the dome rises 275 feet, you know, in the air, and I saw a guy right at the very, very peak of it, and I thought, boy, I'm glad I don't have his job.
Okay, Bill, we'll watch that. It's going to take many months, I assume.
That's right. There's going to be scaffolding set up probably until about Thanksgiving time, but then they will continue work inside, doing a lot of tuck pointing, you know, making sure, restoring the structure, making sure that it's good. You know, it's been up there for many, many years and over 100 years, and they want to make sure that it will be up there for a long time. But the actual project won't be completed until the fall of 2018.
Quickly, Bill, will this affect visitors wanting to look up from the rotunda?
That's exactly right. Tours inside the dome will be halted until the restoration is finished, and I think they've already been stopped.
All right, Bill Petrosky. A couple of quick hits on reporting he's been doing for the Des Moines Register this week. State government reporter for the Register, Bill Petrosky. Always good to talk with you, Bill.
Thank you very much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Speaking of quick hits, that's what we are all about on Friday. Quick conversations to end the week. Some serious, some lighter ones. Let's get to a lighter one. This will bring a smile to your face. This week, Blank Park Zoo welcomed its newest member of the family, a baby camel. They've named it Sunny. And Kevin Dries is with us now, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at Blank Park Zoo. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We have a few minutes here. Tell me about Sunny. What kind of camel is she, right?
That's correct. It is a female. It was born on April 2nd, and it's a Bactrian camel, which most people call the two-hump, as opposed to the one-hump dromedary camel. They're actually very different species of camel. The Bactrian is from Mongolia, lives in the desert, but it also is very cold desert. So it's easily adapts to Iowa's winter, and the species is out year-round as you drive up to the zoo.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of the Bactrian camels around the world?
There really isn't. The Bactrians are much rarer than the one-humped camels, and what we have at the zoo is what's usually considered the domesticated form of the Bactrian, and as far as the wild Bactrians, there are less than 1,000 individuals in the wild, so it's considered a critically endangered species of animal.
Mm-hmm. So how's Sonny doing? And mother and father, do they hang around with Sonny?
Generally, we no longer have the sire or the father of Sonny here, but her mother's name is Tuya, and this is Tuya's third calf born at the zoo. She had the first one was Jolly, the second one was named Randy, and this is Sonny. Unfortunately, about a year ago, we lost the sire, but the gestation of camels is so long, usually 13 to 14 months, that Sonny was conceived prior to the loss of Nikolai, is what we had named the father.
Mm-hmm. And when a camel is newly born, are they, just to give us a sense, are they like horses? Do they stand up right away?
Yes, I would say maybe even a little quicker than horses. They're up on their feet. She was born at over 100 pounds, so she was a good-sized baby camel. In fact, the very first calf that Tuya had was only about 70 pounds. So as the mother's gotten bigger through the seasons, why, so has her babies. But, yep, they're up. They're fuzzy, and they were kind of born with this unique kind of hair. And if you get a chance to see her, which she's on exhibit now, if you drive up to the zoo, you can see Sonny. And she'll be out there with her mother, and then we also have two other female camels in the group.
Mm-hmm. She's named Sonny. I wonder, Kevin, do camels, this type of Bactrian camel, generally have a sunny disposition with people?
Well, that's a good question. You know, camels camels aren't necessarily known for as easygoing. You know, they have been sort of domesticated for a beast of burden, and so they're usually put to work. But camels, like llamas, they do have their way of letting you know when they're displeased about something, and that usually involves, regurgitating a cud and spitting it. So,
yes.
I wouldn't necessarily say that they have a sunny disposition, but when they're little, they sure do. Sunny likes being outside in this weather. She's kicking up her heels, just like you imagine a little lamb out in the pasture. That's kind of what the little camel is like.
What do these type of camels like to eat most?
Oh, it's a pretty big, they're very efficient eaters. Really, hay and a pelleted herbivore diet pellet is really all it takes for them to do well. And the adults can weigh up to a ton. So Bactrian camels are big creatures.
Wow, that is. And in those humps, those are fat deposits? Is that what I remember?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's not water. It is fat. And they do, the humps sort of show what the nutritional background has been to the animals, because the humps can get floppy. If the fat is started to be used up, they can actually get smaller. They can tip over, too, as they lose their turgidity from less fat in there. So we like to see, good solid humps that show that the animal is getting all the nutrition it needs. But that is one of the ways that camels survive in their harsh climate. And plus, and people wonder, well, why is the fat on the back? Because they really don't. Sometimes you think of other animals, the fat is maybe deposited in the abdomen is probably the more normal area. But there is some advantage to having the fat on the back that helps insulate from the sun. Again, we're back in the desert. So there actually is an advantage to having that fat in between you and the sun, because it kind of shelters your internal organs.
All right. Kevin, fascinating. All kinds of fascinating things that we don't have time for about the Bactrian camel, the newest baby, Sonny. You can see it at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Always good to talk with you, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a guest we've had on before. I'm always excited to have her on because we get to think of our food not just as something that we cook up and that's good tasting, but also we get to think of it as medicine. Dr. Terry Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, and she conducts research on studying the use of diet and lifestyle interventions in autoimmune and other chronic diseases. She currently has a trial featuring what is called the Walls Paleo Diet. It received support, we talked about last time she was on, of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Now she's come out with a new cookbook, more than 150 recipes that have healing in mind. It's called The Walls Protocol Cooking for Life, the revolutionary modern paleo plan to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions. And Dr. Terry Walls, of course, lives in Iowa City, but she's in New York City on a book tour. I hope we're connected with you, Dr. Walls. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben.
You have been a leader in this field of very quickly growing field of functional medicine for many years. Tell us in a nutshell, what is it about? How should we think of functional medicine?
So functional medicine really looks at the root causes of the diet, lifestyle, and environmental factors that interfere with how we run the chemistry of life and therefore lead to the development of disease states. Mm-hmm. So if we help people address those root causes, the diet and lifestyle factors, environmental factors, we improve how the chemistry of life works for that person and often can reduce their need for prescription medication, improve their health and vitality.
And
it's really gratifying.
And how much scientific evidence has come to light just in the last few years that functional medicine is really worthwhile?
Well, you know, we keep getting more and more information about the power of the microbiome, that is the bacteria in our gut, in creating health, and better understanding the power of diet, lifestyle, environment to shift which genes are turned on and off. So as we get better understanding of the mechanisms, how these environmental factors work, the basic scientists are very, very excited about this stuff. And there are more people doing clinical trials like I am. They're looking at this more integrative approach to restoring health and vitality.
Mm-hmm. You say that our bodies need to take in all kinds of things, the minerals, the vitamins, antioxidants, essential fatty acids from foods, but not from pills and supplements. Why? What's the difference?
Well, if you take things in food, you get them in the appropriate ratios. For example, our fatty acids, it's really very helpful to have a ratio of the omega-6 to omega-3 at about a 3-to-1 ratio. That's the best for the brain. Your zinc and copper should be in a ratio. And if we take lots of zinc supplements for a while, you'll feel great, particularly if you're zinc deficient. But over time, you'll have too much zinc, and you'll be zinc poisoned. But if you ate liver once a week, you'd be getting plenty of zinc, plenty of copper, plenty of these other minerals, all in the right ratios that your body could utilize.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can give us an example. You've got about 150 recipes. I'm holding the book right now, Dr. Walls. Beautiful book, lots of pictures. I'm getting hungry. It is lunchtime, though. Give us an idea, an example or two of a recipe from your book that you would recommend with a specific condition that would be targeted with it.
Well, greens are incredibly important and helpful for folks. So I'm going to give you two recipes that you can think about. One are green smoothies. This is something your kids would really love and enjoy. You can start with a cup of parsley greens chopped up. And you can even use the stems so you don't have food waste. And 1 to 2 cups of green grapes, ice, and water. Blend that up in a blender. And that'll be a lovely green smoothie that's still plenty sweet. And I think your kids would enjoy that immensely. Mm-hmm. Then the other is cooked greens, bacon and greens. I fry up a couple slices of bacon, chop them up, leave the bacon fat in the skillet, add a chopped kale or chopped beet greens or chopped spinach. Stir the greens just till they're wilted. Add the broken up bacon and serve. And I'll tell everyone that that is my family's favorite vegetable, including my children when they were teenagers, including their teenage friends, that if you have saturated fat, be it ghee or bacon with the greens, it gets rid of the bitterness and really makes these vegetables that we think of as maybe being too bitter into something that's incredibly delicious.
Mm-hmm. Tie the foods you've just mentioned, perhaps, into this idea that of functional medicine and how much, as you said earlier, the microbiome in our gut is, we're realizing it is so important to our health and perhaps turning back some diseases. What is going on when I have that green smoothie that makes my what my little power plants or my microbiome so happy?
So your microbiome lives on the carbohydrates that we can't easily digest. So it's the fiber, the resistant starch, sometimes called microbial accessible carbohydrates, that our bacteria in our colon eats, digest, make short-chain fatty acids. They're also important to our brain health and help make some more additional vitamins and antioxidants that we will absorb. The greens in particular have a lot of vitamin K1 that the bacteria in our bowels will digest, make into vitamin K2, MK7, that our distal small bowel will absorb into our bloodstream. That vitamin K2 will help us transport the calcium in our bloodstream into our teeth and our bones and not into our heart valves and blood vessels. Vitamin K2 is also critical for making myelin, which is the insulation on the wiring in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us are very short on our vitamin K2 reserves, which is part of why we have problems with early cognitive decline and problems with osteoporosis.
And many of our listeners will know your background, your personal background here with multiple sclerosis. But for those who don't, give us that quickly. It wasn't too long ago, and we knew each other at that time. You were confined to a wheelchair.
Confined to a wheelchair, could not sit up in a regular chair. I had to be in a zero-gravity chair, fully reclined, or in bed. It was a struggle to walk 10 feet. I was having cognitive decline. I was having severe fatigue. And during that time, as I was getting more disabled from my MS, I was studying the basic science, studying functional medicine, studying ancestral health. I created a diet and lifestyle program designed specifically for my brain, for my mitochondria, to slow my decline, because I knew that with progressive MS, you never recover functions once lost. But to my amazement and the amazement of my family and my treating neurologist, I not only stopped my decline, I recovered remarkably. I can now bike 20 miles with my family. I'm writing books. I'm traveling the world. I'm doing research.
Amazing.
And, you know, I take my dog on hikes. So life is extraordinary.
Uh-huh. So what are the implications of your research? And in the couple minutes we have left,
sure.
We want to remind people, you recently got a $1 million grant from the MS Society to study the effects of your diet here. How is that? What's the update there?
So that's going really well. We've got 25 people in the study. We'll be recruiting up to 100. We have quarterly meetings with the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and they're very pleased with our progress. That's going very, very well. I'm writing grants to replicate the kind of work that I do for ALS. We're writing up papers that describe our experience with the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic when I was at the VA, where we use these kind of diet principles with people with other autoimmune diseases like lupus, RA, psoriasis, some early Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, and the favorable things that we saw there. So, you know, just many very positive things are happening. We've had another research paper that came out in the Journal of American College of Nutrition about the favorable changes on mood and the thinking abilities that we saw in our first MS patients.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, in just a couple sentences, forecast this forward, where functional medicine, diet as medicine will be. Are we just awakening to it? We have a lot to learn yet?
You know, it is so exciting. I think the public is driving interest. The public is very interested in diet and lifestyle. Physicians are coming along behind that. I just see this growing further and further. Hopefully the public and physicians will realize the root of health is diet and lifestyle. It is not prescription drugs. It is diet and lifestyle.
Okay. Dr. Terry Walls, clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine. Her new book, it's a companion book to her first book, really. This is called The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life, the Revolutionary Modern Paleo Plan to Treat All Chronic Autoimmune Conditions. Dr. Terry Walls joining us, though she's home at here in Iowa. Today she's in New York City on a book tour. Dr. Walls, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, with help from Chelsea Hoy and Anna Williams. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Well, we hope you have a wonderful Easter weekend. Drive safely if you're off to visit the relatives. We'll talk to you again next week. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Take care.